It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
No Maria again this week.
No Maria again this week. She is still out sick, so we hope to have her back next week, and maybe hopefully she won't spread the bubonic plague.
Yeah. Oh, well, we might have time to get to that later.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we got plenty to cover and
not much time to do it.
Let's do it. So we started last week with your Eat the State Voters recommendations.
Yes.
The State Voters Guide, I was going to call it. It's kind of a voter's guide. A lot of people turn to it.
And we got it up on the web now. At least I believe we do.
I checked last night.
Yeah, I thought so. So the election recommendations are up at www.eatthestate.org. We covered county last week, so we wanted to cover city this week. And starting off with the mayor's race. Now, I have to say I was really impressed yesterday with Greg Nichols. I went down to the press conference in which he essentially killed the monorail. And he said all the right things. He was really a show of tough leadership, making a tough decision. But he has simply done too many things that are questionable over the past 4 years. Sucking up to Vulcan Ventures and Paul Allen on the South Lake Union stuff. He's really pushed a pro-development agenda at every turn at Northgate and U District and South Lake Union, and so. So it would be nice to vote for somebody else. Unfortunately, there is no real good contender this year. There's no, even among the alternative candidates, there isn't a lot to pick from. For progressive politics, there's a couple people running, Crystal Wood and the socialist workers Chris Hoepner. Neither one of them are really viable candidates. I'm going with Al Runty, who's a former UW professor. He's been on this program before. Got some good ideas. Doesn't have the kind of political experience you might want for managing a city of 11,000 employees. But you can't hope for everything. And this is basically a protest vote. This is saying, Greg Nichols, we're going to have another 4 years of you. We don't want you pushing a pro-development agenda. You need to know that there are people in the city who are not pleased with what you're doing. And so that's the idea behind that vote.
Very good. And that leaves us with the city council next.
Yes, the city council. We also have the school board and the monorail authority.
Right.
And the city council. Three city council positions up for grabs. The fourth one, Nick Licata, has only one opponent running against him, so that'll be in the general election in November. The three are position two, in which Richard Conlon is running for re-election. Conlon can be kind of maddening. He can be very good on some things and very bad on others, but he's been one of the only consistent voices on city council who's questioned the Nichols development agenda. And for that alone, I think he deserves re-election. The other factor in this race, of course, is that his opponent, Paige Miller, is just dreadful. She is a pork commissioner. She's taken junkets all over the world on the taxpayer dime. She's part of...
I think it was more than a dime.
Yeah. She's part of everything that is questionable and dubious and corrupt about the Port of Seattle and the way it does business. And we'll talk about the Port of Seattle in a minute. Oh, no, we did that last week, didn't we?
We did.
But... we don't want Paige Miller on the city council. We want Richard Conlon. He is a good choice. He's deserved re-election. Position number four, we have Jan Drago, who definitely does not deserve re-election. She's by far the most pro-business candidate running this year. Very conservative, conservative pro-business Democrat. Very bad on social issues. And in this race, unfortunately, we had the two most progressive people running for city council are running in the same race against each other. Those would be Linda Averill and Angel Bolaños. I like Averill a lot. I think she's sharp. I think she's intelligent. She has a lot of good things to say. She's backed by radical women in the Freedom Socialist Party, which is a little too sectarian for my comfort. But she's certainly a good vote. I'm going with Bolaños. I think it would be good to have a person of color on the city council. He's equally progressive. He's articulate, even though he has a thick accent that sometimes masks what he has to say. I like him a lot. So Bolaños in position number four.
And I got to stop you for a second. And what about Casey Core? What's your thoughts on him?
I don't really know what to make of Casey Core. He's been on Greg Nickel's staff for the last 4 years, and that's definitely a strike against him. At the same time, he had done a lot of good things as a columnist for the PI and Times. What is it about media figures in this city who are running for political office? I mean, there's just so many of them. And no, I'm not going to.
Yeah, you say that now.
Yeah. But I'm really mixed on Casey Core. I think he could potentially make, you know, if it comes down in the general to him and Jen Drago, I will definitely support Core. But for the time being, both Bolaños and Averill are better choices.
Very good. All right.
And then we have the other race, position number eight. It is with Richard McIver and Dwight Pelz. And I really tried to find a reason for backing the third person in this race, a landlord named Robert Rosencrantz, and I just can't. I mean, I just can't find anything. And the McIver versus Pelz race is a real stickler for me. I don't think McIver deserves re-election. He's been an inert presence on the city council for 8 years. He really hasn't done anything, but take up, you know, a warm body and space on the council. On the other hand, Pelz, very close friends with the Nickels from their time on county council together. All for the South Lake Union development. You know, he's a solid liberal progressive who's done a lot of good things on the county council as a representative for Southeast Seattle. But at the same time, his agenda for the city is really troubling in several respects. So for this race, I'm not recommending either one of them. I'm saying skip that one. I can't really endorse either Pelz or McIver in that race, or Rosencrantz for that matter.
Hmm. All right.
Let's see, we have the school district now. We have several races here also. District number five, that's a central district. Mary Bass is running for re-election. And, you know, Bass is losing a lot of endorsements and sort of the old boy network that would really like to see the reform movement in the city and the school board be overturned. Bass was really the first one of those. She was questioning Olszewski when questioning Olszewski was not cool. And for that, she deserves re-election. She is a very good representative of her constituency in the central district. She has a lot of meetings with area residents and parents and teachers. Has been a very, very good representative, I think, deserving re-election. She is running against... what's the name? Jane Fellner, I believe, is her name. She's running against, somebody who's been around the school district for a number of years, kind of plugged into all the wrong places, if you know what I mean. we have district number seven, Carol... This is an open seat. Cheryl Chow is the best known of the names running for this, the former city council person who's been essentially looking for elected office to get elected to ever since she left the city council. She doesn't deserve this one either. She's been bad news everywhere she's gone, really, and had a horrible time on the county council, or in the city council. So that leaves three other people: Linda Thompson Black, who's backed by Norm Rice and other local rainmakers; Alan Lloyd, who isn't great; he doesn't have education experience, but he's the one I'm going with. He opposes abolition of the choice system, which would be a nightmare for South End students. This is a South End district, I think Lloyd is the pick there. Teresa Cardamone is also a very good candidate in this race, an anti-Wassel candidate that a lot of people are backing. Leaves us with those are the only two, I thought there was a third.
I don't have it in front of me. I'm going to have to trust notes, which is very dangerous.
I think those are the only two.
All right.
And then we have the monorail board. Now, you can go a couple of ways on this, because the two elected positions in the monorail board are both people up for re-election. And you can say either that they've been the most outspoken questioning on the board, or you can hold them responsible as board members for the mess that the monorail is in. And you can also say that having been on the board, they're vested in the system. They want to keep the monorail alive, and what is needed at this point is somebody to come in and just give it a quick, merciful death. And I really think that's where we are with the monorail right now. We just need to spike it and start over. So for that reason, I'm going with the anti-monorail candidates in these two. The first position, position number 8, Cindy Laws, has the additional handicap. She's been a very outspoken board member. Unfortunately, sometimes her tongue is a little too loose. She had a comment about the Jewish downtown interests that had been opposing the monorail, and you know that kind of racism is not appropriate in an elected official, no matter how she explains it. Some people are willing to forgive that, and I'm not. So I'm going with her opponent on that race, who is
Beth Goldberg.
Beth Goldberg.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to kill the monorail, and I say more power to her. In the other position, position number 9, Cleve Stockmeyer is the one running for re-election, and I say would say again that the candidate to go with would be the one opposing the monorail, and that's Jim Nobles. So we're pushing Nobles in that race.
All right. And what about Dick Falkenberry, the guy who was originally the visionary for the monorail?
I would just wonder if he's have too much of a problem killing his pet idea. Again, it was a wonderful idea. It's a shame that the monorail has come to this, but it really has Joel Horn and Tom Weeks and their cabal mercilessly exploited the monorail and taxpayer money for the past 3 years. And I don't think there's any salvaging of it at this point.
All right. Well, it's kind of too bad that Maria isn't here with us, because I know she disagreed with or had different opinions on some of these picks.
Yeah, she wanted Teresa Cardamone in the school board race, I know, and she she had a different take on the monorail ones as well. So,
but her review of things is up on the ETS website.
Yes, it is.
So people can check that out. All right. Anything else for the Seattle positions, or
no? Let's move on to this week in the world.
All right. Well, real quickly, we finished up with the monorail there, and yesterday, Greg Nichols. I guess we already talked about that, didn't we?
A little bit, yeah. Again, I think he did a good thing. It almost pains me to say it, because I've been so critical of Greg Nichols on this program in the past, but he said all the right things in his reasons that he gave for taking the action that he did, and it will be up to the monorail board now this coming Wednesday night as to whether they put a measure on the ballot for November or whether the city council does on Thursday. One way or another, we're going to be voting on the monorail yet again for a fifth time.
Yeah.
And I think the vote this time has to be pretty clear. Unless the monorail board can come up with a really, really compelling plan between now and November that convinces voters that they've got their act together. And I just don't see that happening. I don't think they have the time. I don't think they have the money. I don't think the revenues from the excise tax will be enough to cover it. And they've already made so many compromises to the Green Line in terms of the safety, in terms of the ergonomics, if you will, of the project. Every way you want to look at it, it's just a compromise project at this point, and we need to just start over.
All right. Moving along to national stuff, New Orleans and Louisiana is they're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's still in Louisiana. It might have floated off by now.
Yeah. But they're talking about some big infusion of capital down there.
Yeah, and you got to wonder where it's coming from. And you also got to wonder if this isn't a bed that George Bush made, because he inherited a surplus in the federal treasury, and that surplus could have been used for exactly such emergencies as this. Unfortunately, we don't have that federal surplus anymore. It was frittered away in tax cuts for the wealthy and on a war in Iraq. And again, the natural disaster is a compelling reason to get out of Iraq. We have our National Guard stretched too thin. We can't take care of people here at home. George Bush is saying he won't raise any taxes, and he hasn't made any specific announcements of things that he wants to cut. There's certainly all kinds of pork in Congress that could be cut. The transportation bill that was passed recently, with, you know, the bridge to nowhere in Alaska and all of the sorts of pet projects that for congressional districts that, that were stuffed into the bill. That certainly could be revisited. But, you know, $200 billion is a lot of money compounded by the interest that will be racked up when we're paying on it down the road. You know, that kind of money's got to come from somewhere, and the most obvious place it could come from is to stop the war in Iraq. Is to just get out. That's a compelling reason to do it, because we can't afford to have that much more money piled onto the national debt.
And it appears that a bunch of the same players that were cashing in Iraq are now moving facilities,
Halliburton,
into,
you know, all
Louisiana,
the rest, yeah,
cashing in down there.
Very much so. A lot of the people cashing in Louisiana are the companies that are well-connected Republican donors that are getting no-bid contracts on an emergency basis to come in under FEMA. That was the other thing I wanted to talk about, is that FEMA is really apparently bungling the relief effort 3 weeks in now, and you have people scattered in shelters all over the south central part of the country that aren't getting aid. You know, they're supposed to be setting up distribution centers for FEMA in all these different cities around you know, Baton Rouge and Gulfport and Biloxi and all the different places where various evacuees have landed. And most of it hasn't happened yet. Still, 3 weeks out. And, you know, the federal government is still bungling this. It's not just a question of the rescue effort in the first few days after the after the hurricane. It's still happening. It's a real mess.
But there are plenty of organizations that, you know, beyond that are helping out, doing good work.
Yeah, that's been the real positive spin of this, is that there's been a lot of outpouring of generosity from the American public. You know, if you're a refugee from New Orleans, you know, everywhere you go, people are welcoming and willing to put you up and help you out. It's been a real heartwarming story in that respect, but the response of the federal government has just been abysmal. And it's really the generosity of the American public and the various nonprofits that have been helping out, have made a huge difference. And the government has made a huge difference also, but it hasn't been what it needs to be.
And just real quickly, I'd gotten somebody forwarded me an article the end of last week, right after the show, about another disturbing trend there, that the company Blackwater, which had been involved with, it still is, having mercenaries in Iraq, had people patrolling the streets, and maybe still has people patrolling the streets down in New Orleans. And that's one of the security firms that's been brought in, one that's, you know, clearly is mercenary ties. And
Lot of privatization is the key word here. A lot of the war effort in Iraq has been privatized, where you see these mercenary firms, these security firms coming in, and a lot of the relief effort has been privatized also. FEMA contracts out. FEMA is a very small agency by itself. It doesn't really have a lot of its own employees. It has to contract out for almost all of these various services, and those are the firms that they're going to. Again, the well-connected firms that have Republican ties that can get no bid contracts and that can mobilize quickly. That's what's happened.
All right. Well, let's jump to international. Afghanistan has got elections coming up.
Yeah, elections coming up tomorrow, and what Human Rights Watch calls an underlying climate of fear. What you've got is a situation in which a lot of the former warlords in Afghanistan are simply running for political office. It doesn't make it democracy just because you're having elections. And you've had a wave of violence in which a number of the parliamentary candidates have been killed. I think the eighth was killed yesterday. the United States and the you know the various other countries that represent an occupying force in Afghanistan really haven't been able to do very much about it. The Taliban has been getting markedly stronger over the past several months. This is something where the United States hasn't had the ability to pay much attention to it because all of its troops are stretched thin in Iraq. They have relatively few troops in Afghanistan at this point. So the elections are coming up tomorrow, and we'll see how many people vote, and we'll see. We'll see how much more violence attends the elections themselves.
But those troops in Afghanistan still are very active. They're still getting killed at a regular rate, which doesn't seem to make much news. And there's still major operations there where they're, calling in, airstrikes, things like that. And
there's major operations there. They're just not nearly at the scale that they are in Iraq. And again, they need to be because... from the standpoint of the United States, if you're going to put a lid on this kind of violence, you need to have the troops to do it. And they haven't done that in Iraq, and they're not doing it in Afghanistan either.
Moving on to, then, This Week in Iraq.
Well, we talked last week about the Constitution and the standoff between the United Nations and the United States. That continued this week. The Shiites handed the United Nations what they now call the final version of the draft Constitution that's scheduled for a vote now less than a month away on October 15th. But they still haven't passed it through Parliament. Remarkably enough, what the Shiites are saying is, well, we have a controlling number of people in Parliament, so we don't need to pass it. We can just have people vote on it. This is a little like the Republicans controlling Congress saying, "Well, we don't need to vote on a bill. We can because we have a controlling voice in Congress. So we'll just call it a day." Unfortunately, this isn't a bill. This is an entire constitution for a country. And they haven't had a vote on it. They haven't had any kind of a record of who's in favor or who's against. So the United Nations is insisting on a vote before it will distribute and before it will print and distribute the 5 million copies that are necessary to distribute to people around the country so they can look at the Constitution, debate it, and decide whether they want to vote for it on October 15th. Again, this is coming very much down to the wire. It's already past the wire in some respects. The ability of people to decide on this is being very much compromised by the fact that there's been no final draft available. The United States has been on the side of the Shiites on this and saying there's no need for an actual vote. It's been the United States deadline all along that's represented the problem here, that there's been this artificial deadline that's been cast that's forced what's really been a fairly incomplete document. Maria's talked in past weeks about what's in that document, and how it's a pretty dreadful constitution to begin with. That's stalemated as we go to press, as it were, this week. At the same time, we've had a bombing campaign that's been starting up in these past couple weeks in the north part of the country near the Turkish border, a place called Talifar on the Syrian border near Iraq. A lot of Turkmens that live in that area have tried to flee to the north, but the United States has not allowed them toward Turkey, but the United States has not allowed that, so they've been pushed toward the south where the Iraqi police are. The Iraqi police represent a real problem in a lot of these areas. There's been a lot of accusations of mistreatment of prisoners, even the deaths of a number of prisoners, a lot of torture of detainees. This is something that the United Nations has really raised a cry over, that the Iraqi police, who have been trained by the United States, have been engaging in torture and murder and a number of other fairly unsavory practices that, again, we've talked about on this program in the past. These refugees from this part of this part of Iraq are caught between a rock and a hard place. They're getting bombed on the one hand by the United States, but when they try and leave, they're being pushed into the arms of Iraqi police, Shiite police to the south. So that's a real nasty situation that's developing in Talifar. And that's it for this week in Iraq.
Okay, a minute or less. Your thoughts on John Roberts' hearings this week?
Well, not really much of a surprise. Nobody's been able to lay a glove on him, really, and he knows it. He knows he'll be confirmed. He knows he has the votes. He knows he doesn't have to say anything about what his positions actually are. And his actual positions are probably pretty reactionary, probably pretty... pretty outside the mainstream of what people would want in an activist judge in this country, but he's going to get confirmed anyway. It's in some ways kind of a mockery of the process that the Senate confirmation hearings really haven't told us very much about this guy.
All right. Well, I wanted to make sure we got spend a couple minutes here for
yeah, there's
events
a lot
that
of,
were coming
there's
up.
There's a lot of different events coming up.
Well, I'm sure I'm missing a whole bunch of them, but... coming up today, Saturday, this evening at Elliott Bay Books, Bob Fitrakis, who is a co-author of Did George W. Bush Steal America's 2004 Elections? Essential Documents. They have compiled everything you could ever imagine on what happened in Ohio and beyond, and he's going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at Elliott Bay Books. He's also going to be on the show tomorrow morning at 7:30 a.m.
Very, very good guy.
Coming up tomorrow, as you heard from the 7:30 to 8 hour, the 2005 Pike Market Buskers Festival is going from 10 to 5, so go check that out, Pike Place Market. And then Monday...
Free.
That's
absolutely
free.
It's free.
All they ask for is your rapt attention. Monday, the evening, Barbara Ehrenreich will be speaking. She's author of Nickel and Dimed and talking about her new book, Bait and Switch. That's 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall. And then Tuesday night, British MP George Galloway will be in town.
Oh, wow.
He is going to be speaking at Kane Hall at 7 p.m. So there you have it.
Galloway is very, very good. He's very articulate. And also we've got demonstrations against the war coming up next weekend also. So
next Saturday, right?
Next Saturday here and in Washington, D.C.
So, yeah, whichever place is closer to you.
And various other places around the country as well. So.
Well, talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And Jav, tell people where they can find Eat the State.
The election picks and everything else in Eat the State can be found anywhere you find free publications and rags that you wipe your whatever with, bookstores, cafes, places like that. You can also find us on the web. And again, those picks are up on the web at www.eatthestate.org. It's all one word.